Okay, I might make a start, not blindingly rush the time here or anything, but at least we managed to show up here. So far we've done kind of, if you like, half of the GNOME platform to a certain extent, or of the type of stuff you're going to use, maybe two-thirds of the time you'll spend your time down in GTK and glib and gconf and things like that. We're moving up the stack a bit at the moment, and I'm missing huge portions here, but again, I'm trying to give you the big goalposts where to look. So now we're getting up to the point where every now and again, the whole, like, remember, GNOME's meant to stand for GNU Network Object Modeling Environment, or Object Model Environment. We may possibly have wandered off that path over the last couple of years, but every now and again, we remember the word networks in there. And so things are meant to work over networks and meant to be able to run applications from other machines and things like that. And there's also been always this kind of goal, pipe dream if you talk to the wrong people, that we'd like to have things being sort of fairly componentized so that, in theory, building a moderately complex application is a matter of pulling in a few of the right components that other people have generously written for you beforehand and adding your own sort of framework around it. We're not quite there, but this could be just, it's early days. You've got to maybe have a toolkit around for 20 years before that happens, and that never happens. So it's unclear what's going on there. But look, the support is there, and as I'll show, there's quite a few applications of this stuff. It's not like we've written code that we're hoping somebody will use. I'm not talking about anything here today that is practically useless. Like, everything I'm talking about exists now and is used in real applications, since this is meant to be a practical tutorial. So the Bonobo infrastructure is despised by some, loved by others, and most of us just get along with it. It's a way to create reusable components. It's a layer built on top of Corba, designed to make a lot of the Corba interaction easier. There's quite a good paper that Miguel Diaketha wrote many years ago, 1999, 1998 maybe, explaining the original dream that he and Nat Friedman and SRA had for what Bonobo components were going to be. We haven't quite met that dream, but we've sort of got pretty close. It's, imagine you've got components sitting around, you say, okay, please give me any component that can handle a text view or a Nautilus component display or something like this. Yes? Yeah, okay, now I'm getting to that. So, no, reasonable question. The sort of thing here is we're saying, okay, I'm about to display some text, or I'd like to put a text widget in here so that people can edit their email, and maybe they want to edit their email in HTML or maybe in plain text, but do all that stuff that we do when we're editing email. So please, Mr. System, do you have anything lying around that can be used to compose email? And instead of giving you back a whole application, like you don't want to have set up a whole new application to this, you'd like to essentially get a widget back that someone's already designed that already has all the code and the logic in it for writing an email, so it understands about things like quoting and possibly reformatting paragraphs and not going past certain columns and all sorts of crazy things like that. Or you might want someone to have written a widget that can view PDF files or that can play a chess game or something like that. But by a component, I mean a self-contained piece of code that serves some function and it has a clearly defined interface that you talk to. So you can pass it information, it can pass you information, but it doesn't require you to have been reading its source code. It sort of said, okay, here's the interface used to talk to me, and here's the service I offer. And the idea was that at some point we'll get a whole bunch of well-known services that people can call up. I will see some examples in a slide or two of how this kind of works today to a certain extent. Just a brief bit of history that is quite true, but not so well known these days. Bonobos are monkeys, endangered species of monkeys, meant to be the closest relations to humans in a certain sense. But the main reason for using Bonobo for these components was these monkeys are fairly friendly types, and they're rumored to have sex up to about 6 times a day. So when Miguel was looking around for something to name pluggable components, Bonobo seemed like a fairly appropriate thing here. But we don't share that news with everybody because, frankly, it scares them away. So there's sort of two sides to the bonobo argument. There's lib bonobo, which is, if you like, the server side of the equation. And it's basically responsible for, if you're handing off components to another application, or if you're an application saying, give me a bit of code, give me a component or a widget that I can use to display a PDF, something on the other end has to basically create that widget, and when it callbacks and signals are made and whatever to display the PDF, something has to be running all that code. And that's the server side. And we often talk about having factories that produce these components. Basically, you'll have a PDF viewer factory that produces PDF viewers on demand. We often have quite interesting conversations with our translators who are going, what on earth is a factory? Like, they look up their dictionary and they, manufacturing plant? No, that can't be right. They look up all sorts of, there's all kinds of definitions of factory that I never actually heard about until I started sort of trying to help the Serbian guy translate factory into an appropriate word. And we eventually explained what we were talking about here, and it really, and he said, it can't be one of these manufacturing things, can it? But we said, yeah, just like churning out cars or something. It's a factory in the bonobo sense, or in the Corvus sense, is literally a program or a piece of code that just churns out components that it hands off to other applications to display. And when those when that piece of code needs to do something, it calls back over this side and says, okay, please display the PDF, or please jump to this bookmark or something. And as I said, components can essentially activated by name. This is always one of the infrastructure nightmares if you're using something like Corba, is finding out what, or even any kind of remote activation type thing. You always need to find out what the guy on the other end is called and how to get to him. And so with Bonobo, we have a thing called Bonobo Activation, surprisingly enough, that you say, okay, please, do you have anything that meets the, and I'm making up a service here, the text interface 1.0 interface, or the text view 1.0 interface. Do you have anything on the system to do this? And the programs will ask the Bonobo activation server for this. And it will come back and say, yes, look, here's a list of all the things I've got. And you can say, and you can form quite complex queries to this thing. You can say, do you have something that supports the text view interface and the icon view interface and can display PDFs? And probably you'll get nothing back. But you may get something back that meets all of these. Like, you can basically AND and all these things together, and you can say, just give me any one, I don't really care, or give me a list of things and I'll choose them. A lot of things, particularly that people write without caring, tend to implement the famous interface called Bonobo Unknown, which is about as descriptive as it sounds. And that's not too friendly, but in that case, they're basically saying, look, I know there's this thing over here called Elephant, and I want to activate it. And it implements the Bonobo Unknown interface. But that's all right, I know what Elephant does. Which isn't really the whole reusable component way of thinking, but it's what we've stooped to. And as I'm sort of saying there, we haven't really fulfilled this dream of having multiple interfaces, multiple implementations of certain interfaces. But that may not be necessarily a bad thing. It's kind of like the editor wars writ large, if you like, to have multiple implementations of the same interface in many extents. If every person on the planet is using a different thing to view PDFs with, as far as from the maintainer's point of view, it's exceedingly hard to track down bugs. Like, bug fixing when you're calling remote components or widgets and having them come over and sit in your application is fairly fiddly anyway, because if you get a bug, you're never quite sure, is it a bug with me? Is it a bug with their widget? Is it a bug with the bonobo bit in between? Where's the problem lie, and how can I debug it? Because you're kind of debug things that, even though they're running on the same machine, maybe running in two different processes, and life gets a little bit interesting. Life basically ends up in these cases sort of talking to one or two people who understand this in depth, and they get very unhappy because everyone always comes to their bug reports. So it's a little bit fiddly like that. So maybe it's a good thing that for most things we only have one server that does everything. Did I spell that right? Yes. I should point out, libbonobo is a terrible word to spell. There's too many B's and O's and things, and it's easy to start spelling, and it's hard to know when to stop. one of those kind of words. It's Libbonovo UI is, again, very generally, loosely speaking here, is the client side of things. It's the library you use, and this is if you're an application writer often, this is the calls you're going to use to say, I've received a text widget, I now want to put it in a frame in my code. And again, I apologize, this is a little bit of C code, and this is meant to be a fairly language agnostic talk, but I just wanted to give a little bit of an example of what I'm talking about, because Bonobo can be quite hard to grasp. But the idea here is, this is the example of getting, if you have an application that, I don't know, you're writing a web browser or something, and you want to be able to display a PDF file on the screen, and you think that probably on the system somewhere there is a PDF viewer already. For example, GPDF, the GNOME PDF viewer, supplies a Bonobo component as part of its standard installation that views PDFs. So GPDF itself is basically it uses its own Bonobo component to display the PDF, and it wraps a nice frame around it. If I'm going to write something that displays PDFs in my own application, I don't need GPDF's frame and menu structure and everything like that. But I do kind of want its display widget, because it already understands PDFs and I don't. So we just said, like, this is using a few shortcuts and there's no end of things missing here, but it's ultimately contains all of the meat of the problem. Bonobo widget new control says, okay, run off and fetch me something that matches the GNOME PDF server identifier. OFI ID here is, for all intents and purposes, you can just think of it as the arbitrary string we put at the beginning of all our queries to say these are. OAF was the old name for what's now called Bonobo Object Activation Framework back in the GNOME 1 days. Miguel hadn't apparently discovered Bonobos back then, so it was much more mundanely named. And then, okay, we then get back some kind of widget which we add to our container and we show it. And at that point, we have a PDF widget that we can have. And that widget that we've got back, Bonobo widget new control, passes me back something that behaves like a GTK widget. So I can sort of send signals to this thing and I can hook into callbacks and do all the sorts of things that I like. And Bonobo UI and Bonobo are going mad under the covers, making sure that the right information comes across. The ultimate example, the really good example in GNOME of how to use these sort of things if you're looking for sample code to look through, is looking gedit, which is the GNOME sort of editor that has, it started out as a fairly simple editor and it's basically staying fairly simple, but it is fairly featureful and does, like, the guy who maintains it at the moment uses it to write his university papers, and his main motivation for doing all of this stuff was he needed to be able to do LaTeX in it and stuff like that, so he wanted to be able to do his coding in it. So it tended to develop features as he needed them. But that the gedit allows you to have a plug-in mechanism. So you can plug in a spelling checker that will underline the words that are misspelled, or you can plug in a syntax colorer that, so when you load up a language file, it colorizes it for you. Or you can load in a calendar or a shell input window, or who cares what. They're all done as Bonobo components. And it's quite a good example of how to use Bonobo in the sort of sensible way that it was designed for. So that's pretty good code to read, actually. It's moderately clear in places, and it's pretty easy to find the right places to look there. Oh, wait, go back. The other sort of thing you get with Libbonovo and with Libbonovo UI is, if something like, imagine we have a PDF, I'm sucking in a PDF viewing widget and putting it in, it may come with certain menu items that are sort of naturally associated with that widget. Like, it will come with a set the width, set the magnification factor in the widget, and jump to this link or reload the PDF because it might have changed. Various things that are naturally associated with that widget. Did you want to say something? Yes. We've had the break, so you can come and put it in now. They're just going to be quickly installing an airport station underneath my feet here. Okay, maybe I should have got him to wait till the end of the talk. There is no other side. Okay. And so there are often with many widgets, there is sort of a natural set of menu items that might come with these widgets. The problem is your main application already has a set of widgets. Just wait, they're throwing me off. Okay. That's all right. We're ahead of schedule anyway, so you want to like sing a song or something, go for it. Okay. And because your main application already has menus associated with it, you don't want to have the Bonobo widget just sort of throwing up its own menus and hoping that it might blend in magically with your menu bar. So Bonobo supports this idea of menu merging. The widget itself says, okay, here are some menu items that I want to put in, and can you please merge them into the appropriate menus? And if you don't have a menu called foo, then please create a menu called foo and put it in. If you already have a file menu, please put this guy into the file menu at around this spot. So again, that's sort of a win for us following consistent menu guidelines, because it means that you do tend to merge into the right menu most of the time. Because if I use the file menu for file related stuff and someone else uses the file menu for display related stuff, then the menu merging might go a bit wonky. But because we're fairly consistent about what goes in what menus, that tends to work out fairly nicely. For example, in gedit, if you add in a new, like if you add in the spelling checker plugin, then under the tools menu, which is normally empty, you get a check my spelling, suggest synonyms, all that sort of jazz being merged in as menus. Sorry, was there a question up there? Yes. Okay. I'm not on completely certain ground here, but basically you can tell Glade that I would like to insert a Bonobo component into this frame. You can't tell it what the Bonobo component is or anything like that, because that happens at runtime. But basically Glade has a concept of this is a Bonobo blob that's going in here. And so it knows to create the right sort of frame that can accept the widget. You've still got to do a little bit of code like this to actually dump it in, but that's really a matter of, in Glade, something I didn't mention earlier, when you create any widget at all, you can give it an identifier or a name, and you can then retrieve the widget later on by name. So you basically say, okay, give me the widget with the name Bonobo frame, and that's where I'm poking this thing into. So the support is there, it's just when you're designing the UI, you've sort of got to use your imagination a bit to see what's there. Yes? Yeah, sort of. Not that's being used a lot. Like there was, for example, there was the, at one point, you could grab web pages inside Nautilus, for example, which was essentially using Gecko, the Mozilla rendering engine underneath. But at the moment, we're actually going the other way, where we're looking at being able to do Bonobo plugins to things like Mozilla, going the other way around and sort of making the web browser be the controlling application and plug things into that. But look, it's not too hard to write one given a reasonable sort of web browsing framework. And that is how things like Epiphany and Galleon work. They take the Mozilla rendering window and... No, they don't. No, but it's not too much of a stretch beyond that to turn it into a Bonobo-like component. Yes? Yes, and they're different. And we're closing in on having 3 or 4 different HTML rendering things in Gnome at the moment. Not surprisingly, this has been seen as possibly a bit of overkill by 2 or 3. The main problem is the GTK HTML2 library, which is what's used in Yelp in the GNOME help system, was sort of written from scratch a couple of years ago because GTK HTML had got a bit messy and out of control and was quite hard to maintain. But unfortunately, GTK HTML still has to hang around for evolution purposes because the Zimian guys have added lots of work to it. In particular, they've added editing to it and things like that, which is quite hard to add into GTK HTML2. And we also have the Gecko rendering stuff for Epiphany or Galleon or Firebird or whatever has it that you're using. So there's kind of an argument we're using more than strictly necessary in the HTML rendering department. But that's not something that you can just change overnight by saying, I wish we had less HTML renderers, because you kind of need two or three projects to stand up and say, okay, we're going to merge with this one, and no one's doing that yet. And they've all got quite good reasons for it. It's not just not invented here problems. There's good technical reasons for this. Okay, moving along. LibGNOME is, if you're starting out to write a GNOME application, there's writing any application, there's sort of a random amount of startup guff you have to do. In GNOME, there's a fair bit of standard stuff that we'd like you to be able to do, like standard flags that we'd like you to be able to pass in, session ID, so the session manager can start you up properly. Like, people don't pass that in very often, but the session manager might. Certain accessibility things, maybe debug flags that go all the way back to GTK. To set things up, things like that, certain standard flags that everyone shouldn't have to implement themselves, various other things that just need to get set up at some point or another. So we've grouped all of this support infrastructure into LibGNOME. And essentially high-level application management gives you the right idea of what's going on there. Very early on in your program, you initialize LibGNOME, which sort of sets up all of the supporting libraries, LibBonobo, all the way down, set up GTK if necessary. And then you can start up your program, and it provides option parsing and things like this. Not necessarily the world's best option parsing, but for most cases it works. It provides support for using the GNOME help system, like a few calls there so that you can hook them up so that when someone presses F1 in your application or selects various things from your help menu, you can load up the right page from the help system in the help browser. Good examples of using this sort of stuff, well, pretty much any GNOME application that uses LibGNOME is meant to have help in it. So that's sort of a matter of looking around it. And pretty much, by and large, most applications will have a help file, and their help menu will contain help and about. And the about will show the credits box, and help will load up the help file. Some fancy applications like Numeric and things like that realize that their help system is enormous, and so they'll have sort of jumping off points. And they can be done with the help system support too. We're not forcing anyone just to have one help file, but if your help file's not too big, it's not too stupid to load the whole thing up. High score handling for games. If you're running a game, it's fairly common to want to keep a list of high scores, keeping them in the one spot so that everyone on the system can use it. So that's sort of a matter of writing to a section that's owned by the games user and stuff like that. It's not the world's most flexible API, sort of showing its age a bit. You're restricted to 10 high scores and exactly 10 and a few little iffy things like this, and there's some possible craziness in there. There may be a bug that I can't quite repeat at the moment that I keep seeing. But basically, that's, again, useful if you're ever writing a game. Displaying URLs in configured application, what I mean here is if you've got a URL in your application for some reason, you want to display an HTTP reference or an FTP reference, you don't want to have to handle all of the HTML rendering and stuff like that. Now, as was suggested before, you could possibly, if we had a sort of a Mozilla Bonobo component or something like that, we could load that up and display it, which is an approach that Nautilus tried a few years ago. But the other way to do it is just say, well, okay, web browsers are, treat them as a slightly special application. People tend to have them open pretty regularly, and they're not too shocked by a web browser opening up. So if you click on a link in an application, let's make it easy for programmers to say, okay, and now fire up the web browser, or if it's already fired up, open a new window or a new tab and show the page over there. And this is used pretty commonly in many places. We've recently in GNOME 2.4, I think, or maybe 2.2, we added support for making this just a one-call function to be able to do this kind of stuff. And there's some generic program process management in LibGNOME that probably should go even as low as in glib for at various points. Like, it could probably be a lot lower down in the stack. But this is just standard stuff to say, because developers tend to get these things wrong of forking off or executing a new process and remembering to clean out the environment so that you don't haul random environment variables along in violation of all security precepts and stuff like that. And forking off things where you want to have stdir and stdout coming back as separate pipes or coming back as the same pipe and various things like that. There's a few different variations on the theme there that have been written and audited a few times to make sure they're correct so that people don't reinvent the wheel badly. You obviously don't have to use libgnome. Like, there are plenty of applications around that don't use it for one reason or another. One sort of drawback of using libgnome is as soon as you use libgnome, you're sucking in a lot of dependencies down the tree. Like, run LDD on an application that uses libgnome and it sort of comes out at about 35 libraries without really trying. That's a little bit of a problem for some people. It's partly sort of a personal preference. Some people really don't want to use that. They only want to use GTK and glib and things like that. Other people don't really mind. My sort of recommendation in the last point there is, unless you have a good reason not to use it, use it. Because it's sort of there. It's being used in a lot of applications. It gets things done properly. You can, in one call to gnome program init, set up the directory where your data directory for your application so that it pulls out icons and things like that from the right location. You can tell it where the help files are stored. You can tell it all sorts of other things like that that your program might need to know, which means that you can happily have your program installed in a prefix that doesn't have to be slash user or slash user local or something like that. Makes things nice and portable. So start when you're writing your application thinking that you're going to be using libgnome. Like, the first thing in your main method in C or the main thing in your in maybe your Python program or something like that is going to be a call to gnome program run, and you may be going to use gnome program init to initialize the program. Start out at that level, and then when you get a bit more used to it, you might be able to make the judgment call to throw it away. But the stuff's there, and it is useful. Libgnome UI, not like the Bonobo UI split. This is purely based on the names. Libgnome UI contains the user interface portions. Libgnome, the theory is, doesn't depend on GTK. In fact, that's in practice. It doesn't depend on GTK, whereas Libgnome UI does depend on GTK. Libgnome UI depends on Libbonobo UI, whereas Libgnome doesn't. It supplies some extra widgets. Originally, it supplied some widgets that are not yet made into GTK, or maybe a little bit more experimental. It also contains some widgets that have dependencies that GTK does not. For example, there's a new file selector that's recently gone into GTK. It will be in GTK 2.4. They're currently doing 2.3 releases for GTK, the development version. When that becomes 2.4, there's a new file selector there. Quite a nice thing. Still a little bit of debate going on about it. Slightly political hot potato, but it's a nice enough thing. It's designed to have various backends plugged into it, depending on what sort of functionality you have for accessing your file system. So by default, it comes with a fairly simple talk to a Unix file system type of backend that works quite nicely. At Libgnome UI, we can put a version in there of the GTK file selector and plug in the backend that knows about Gnome VFS that I'll get to in a minute, the sort of virtual file system layer we have in Gnome for talking to lots of other file systems. And this sort of gives us the presence to be able to do things like talk over HTTP or Samba or whatever to various other things transparently. The move at the moment, for reasonably good reasons, is to move as much as possible out of Libgnome UI and back down as far as possible, quite often to as far as GTK for widgets. This helps, partly it's just forcing us to go over the code and work out what's quite rubbish and what's actually good enough to keep and move it into GTK. And if something's not good enough to put into GTK, why are we using it? What's the problems? What do we have to fix to put it into GTK? It's a good quality control measure. There'll have to be some things that remain in a library like Libgnome UI, whether it's called that or not, or whether it's merged with Libgnome or who knows what, just because of the dependencies problem. You don't want to have everything in the world being a dependency of GDK. You'd like GDK to remain a little bit separate, and then there'll be some dependency problems like that. But by and large, we're moving most things down. There's also stuff in libgnome UI that just nobody's used for years. It's sort of sitting there for compatibility reasons, but it's not really maintained, and we don't see many bug reports about it, and that's not because it's bug-free, it's just not being used. There's some stuff in libgnome UI that is just in the wrong library. Pointed out to me during the break, the session stuff. There's an area in libgnome UI called gnome client that is used by programs to connect to the session manager and stuff like that. That has nothing at all to do with user interface. It's purely application level stuff. It should be over in libgnome. We probably need to look at that at some point. So libgnome UI is kind of a library reaching in its current incarnation the end of its life, but it will live on in some form as we go forward or be merged into another library. But right at the moment, look, if you're developing GNOME applications today, you can happily use things in libgnome UI because we are guaranteeing not to throw away any of the API. We're not going to remove any API before GNOME 3. We may deprecate it. You may have to sort of turn on flags to say, yes, I know I'm using stuff that is not recommended, but we're not going to throw it away. So programs aren't going to stop working all of a sudden. For that reason, they may stop working all of a sudden for other reasons. Libgnome VFS, and there's probably punctuation problems there. But okay, GNOME VFS is yet another VFS system, but we're not quite reinventing the wheel. It's basically a file system abstraction layer. The idea being that many times, most of the things you want to talk to, whether you're talking over the network to a remote system or you're talking to your local system or whatever, what you want to do is pretty much covered by the basic Unix sort of file system calls. Open a file, read it, am I at the end of the file, maybe seek to a certain position if it's a random access type thing, and close the file off at the end and go away happy. So GNOME VFS, in the essentials, provides you with this kind of interface over many different file systems. HTTP, FTP, it knows about how to talk WebDAV, possibly too enthusiastically, but it knows about how to do it. It can talk to remote SAMR machines. There's all sorts of various things people are working on at the moment, putting in the authentication stuff that kind of needs to go there for many. If you're talking to many remote machines, you need to be able to, first of all, log on, and you kind of only want to log on once. So there's things going on. There's recently stuff that's gone into GNOME to try and centralize a lot of our authentication and authorization stuff so that GNOME VFS in particular can happily talk to remote file systems that do have some access control on it. It also has lots of MIME detection code in there so that you can detect the MIME type of a file, or you can make sure you call the right application if you're not quite sure of the MIME type of the file, and detect the MIME type based only on the file name extension, or detect the MIME type based on doing some content sniffing or whatever like that. That's all in GNOME VFS. It has some support for finding various standard directories that is sort of purely a GNOME-specific thing, but stuff like if I want to put something on the desktop, where do I write it to? If I want to look at what's in the user's trash can, where's that stored? Because they're sort of files on the disk. They were much more files on the disk than they are now. They're now more virtual things in the trash. Writing new modules, GNOME VFS is basically a plug-in, dynamically loaded module type thing. At runtime, it can load in whatever modules it needs. They just have to meet a certain interface. Basically, if you're writing a module for GNOME VFS to talk to your new file system that it's never heard of before, you just write a dynamically shared library that has certain entry points. So when it calls VFS init, it sets up the structure and passes it back that contains pointers to the things that it understands how to do. And then from then on, everything just works like magic. So that's kind of cool. So you can write a sort of a GNOME VFS module that talks to a cryptographic file system or something without too much trouble. And you don't need to, because it's written as dynamically loaded stuff, you don't need to recompile GNOME VFS just because you've written a new module, which makes it possible to have third-party modules being shipped to people who have an existing GNOME installation. So fairly, for something like GNOME VFS, much as it was for GDK Pixbuff earlier in the talk, it's kind of important to be able to do that you don't insist that people have to upgrade the core libraries just to get the benefits of your module add-on. Multimedia support. Oh yeah, here we go. Yep. Was there? Yes? Yeah. You don't know. If you're using GNOME VFS, you sort of, it's recommended not to mix and match there either. Just because it keeps the code sort of clean up. But yeah, basically you'd be doing all of your I/O through GNOME VFS, because then you wouldn't have to worry about whether it's a file system on disk or something over HTTP or something. Because basically the idea would be, it would be nice to be able to read and write a file, not caring whether it's on disk or whether it's you're accessing a web dev server on the other side of the world. And if you were to do that using the normal Unix file system calls, you'd have to be doing all the setup and stuff like that yourself with the connection. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the situation is there. Talk to the guy next to you. You know stuff about it. He'd be willing to learn, I'm sure. Sorry, Glenn. Sorry, yeah, Andrew, did you have a... not really sure what you're asking. Come and ask me later and I can actually show you what the interface looks like. I've got all the API documentation here, so we can probably work it out without sending people tears. All right, multimedia support. We're getting back more onto the, if you're writing an application, this is the above the waterline stuff that the user sees, makes your application do cool stuff. GStreamer is sort of a multimedia framework, if you like. It's a library that manages through various plugins to understand any number of audio and video formats, and we're talking dozens of things here. And you sort of pipe them together and you make pipelines out of them. You say, okay, we have various sinks and sources. Data comes out of this guy and goes into this guy, and this guy passes it on a bit more, and let's split the video here so that part of it goes to this guy who munges it around and also goes to this guy, and then later on we'll merge them together again. And we can merge the audio output from this guy in with the video stream and so on. So each plugin only has to handle one thing, like maybe an audio, maybe video, and they can coordinate with each other through a bit of time syncing and stuff like that. There's ways to pass information back and forth. In the sort of simplest case, for example, to play a tune using GStreamy, you do something like say, okay, use the GStreamer file loader, give it the file name, send that to my Vorbis decoder, since probably in a Vorbis format or something, and then send that to the OSS sync to play it through my OSS sound system. And if you do that on the command line, like there's a tool called GST launch that then lets you just pipe these things, whack all these things together, you do that on the command line, happily it's sort of the Paul Mann's music player, plays one song at a time like that. It can work. GStreamer is a very, very nice architecture. It's a little bit of a learning curve to get to learn it, to write modules. To plug together existing modules to play output is not very hard at all. Fortunately, I can duck the whole issue here by just saying, at 13:54, at 13:45 on Thursday, turn up at 13:54, you've missed the first couple of slides. In this room, Steve Baker will be talking about it. Steve Baker, is he here? Thank God. Right. Good. So I can say whatever I like about it. But that's probably the right talk to go along. He's giving in 45 minutes a full talk about what I would try and do in 10 minutes. And he'll probably give demonstrations and everything. So GStreamer is basically the way to do multimedia stuff through GNOME. And it is a very... very nicely developed, lots of enthusiastic, polite developers working on it, and coming along quite nicely. They're working on their documentation. XML support. If you're doing any kind of medium-sized application these days and exchanging data with any sort of third-party applications, it doesn't take too long to get around the problem of having to be able to talk XML in various formats. libXML which is now in version 2.6.4 or maybe 0.5, I'm not sure if you released something today, is a very fast, very correct implementation of various XML standards. Daniel Velliard, a French guy who works for Red Hat, maintains it, having previously worked for the W3C as their XML activity coordinator, so he knows a bit about the spec. Large portions of the mailing list is Daniel pointing to particular places in the specification that people need to read more as answers to questions. But it is a very good library. It's got quite a nice interface. He's very careful about maintaining API and ABI compatibility, binary and programmer interfaces. It builds on, as I mentioned before in the diagram I showed back on the second slide, libxml has no dependencies on anything else in the sort of GNOME stack because it's used so heavily outside of GNOME. We get people from all over the place using it on all sorts of strange machines. It has some really weird build constraints because people have run into problems on VAX machines where file names can't be too long, and depending on where you were building it, they hit that problem. Recently got mail from someone pointing out that if somebody had time, these would be a nice couple of things to change just so he could build it without having to patch it on his Cray. And they may go in at some point. And it's just a very well-used library, which also gives you some sort of faith that it is extremely well-tested. So it implements the XML spec, the XML namespaces spec, xinclude spec, has some schema support. Schemas, for those who maybe know something about it, are a bit of a political hot potato in this sort of area because they impose quite a huge... It's a very large spec, it's a very complicated spec. To get to the point where you say we've implemented the specification and are compliant, there's a large amount of work that has to be done for not a lot of obvious return. And it's quite messy. On the other side of the fence are the RelaxNG, Relax Next Generation guys, led by Jim Clark. And that's a similar thing that does, well, the claim is everything that schema support does and then some. These two things, schema and RelaxNG, just quickly for those who haven't heard of them before, are sort of the next step beyond DTDs. Problem with DTDs, the sort of document type definition files that you get in XML that describe the format of the XML you're allowed to send, they're a bit too loose in some respects. Like, it's very hard to say this field should be a date. All you can say is this field should be data. And so you can do things like that, say it should be a date, it should be a number, there can be between one and three of these things. If this element is present, then you shouldn't have this element. But if this element is present and it has an attribute of date equals yesterday, then you need to have a reason element inside it, things like that. Lots of fairly strict constraints on the data. The other problem with DTDs is it's very hard to compose them. If you take a document type definition from one language, say XHTML, and you want to merge it with SVG data, in theory you can do this because the name XML namespaces let you make sure that element names don't clash. Unfortunately, it's very hard to validate this because you really want to say, here are the two DTDs, put them together and use them to do it. With those two specifications, you can do it through a couple of tricks. RelaxNG just lets you do this, and schemas let you do this kind of arbitrarily. RelaxNG lets you do it almost trivially, saying some of the elements will be from this namespace using this set of validation rules, some of them will be over here using this set of validation rules. But anyway, that's as an aside. LibXML is supporting all this sort of stuff. It's used in a number of applications already in GNOME that require very heavy XML processing. Numeric, for example, is sort of the flagship application here. Huge spreadsheet, Microsoft Excel compliant, that kind of thing. Compatible, sorry, not compliant. And its native save format is gzipped XML. And so libxml itself actually has the support to read in a file that it has been compressed using zlib and will uncompress it on the fly and parse it. So Numeric doesn't even have to worry about reading in and uncompressing and streaming. It just hands it over to libxml and says, hey, here's a compressed file, please go read it. And you can get back, you can either use, it has a number of interfaces. There's the common sort of Sax interface that was originally designed for Java. which is when you're reading in the file, it gives you an event. Hey, I've seen a paragraph tag. Hey, I've seen an emphasis tag. The emphasis tag is now closed. The paragraph tag is now closed. It can give you the DOM tree, which is basically it reads in the whole document and makes a nice little tree out of it. We've got a paragraph tag, contains some text, and it contains an element tag, and it contains some more text, and so on. It also can use something that we've taken from Microsoft C# implementation called XML Text Reader, which is kind of a combination of the two things. It reads things in as a sort of streaming format, and you can progressively build up the tree as you go along. But it's sort of like SACS improved a bit based on a few years experience, and it's a little bit nicer to use than SACS. It's used in Yelp, the GNOME help thing, because again, most of our help documentation is raw XML written using the docbook set of DTDs. And so Yelp reads in documentation, parses it, displays it. Used in even things like Bonobo, because the description files for these components I was talking about earlier, that says sort of, hi, I'm the PDF viewer, and I'll show this in a minute, but something that says, I'm the PDF viewer, and here's how to launch me, here's the factory that launches me, here's what my little automobiles look like, is all an XML file. So libbonobo has to actually read a lot of little XML files when bonobo activation starts up, and libxml is fast enough and good enough to do this. Libxslt, try saying that when you've had a few drinks, is an XSLT processor built on XML. XSLT is just a transformation language saying I get XML input in, I transform it, and something comes out the other end, often a different form of XML or HTML or something like that. And if you ever have to do XML work, definitely I would recommend using libxml above all else. It was kind of interesting in the Linux and open source in government conference on Monday. There was somebody up there talking about an enormous content management system they'd written that was installed in the National Office of Information. Thank you, economy. No E. And what the hell's E? And there they started off using one of the Java-based XML things, and then they moved on to another C one. They eventually came around to using libxml just because they needed to get faster and faster. And that was the one that was being used. That was kind of cool to actually see that being used there. You had a question somewhere? No one? Right. Printing. Oh, this is a fun one. We have a couple of print libraries, libgnome print, and again, we've separated out the application side of things and the user interface side of things. So libgnome print provides the application side of the argument, which is the application. And what I mean by the application side here is the application gives the data, wants to sort of make a page out of the data and maybe paginate things and stuff like that. Libgnome print UI is the part of the library responsible for popping up for example, the print preferences sort of dialog boxes and getting the information about the printer from the user and stuff like that. It's had a slightly checkered history due to various incompatibility problems, some maintainership problems. The key maintainer recently passed away, so we need to find somebody else to maintain it. It's sort of a bit of the black sheep of the family in some respects, in that it's not used as much as it could be, but that could be because it's not quite as high quality as we want it to be, which could be because it's not being used as much as it could be. But it's now getting back to being useful, because something like, for example, Numeric uses it to do its printing, Evolution uses it to do when you print mail from Evolution. So these guys have had to get it into the sort of shape where they can use it. And they didn't run away and write their own printing library. They've stuck with libgnome print and made it kind of work. So it's now being pseudo-maintained by the maintainer of Numeric. And so we hope it'll move along. And it's particularly, the future looks pretty good for printing in GNOME in general, just because we'll be able to leverage a lot off the Cairo stuff that Keith Packard and friends are working on, because that is meant to present a reasonably device-independent way of drawing images. So GTK at some point will get a Cairo backend, and this will make printing fairly easy. That's mostly just for those of you who may have gone to Jim's talk this morning or know something about Cairo. The rest of you just take it on faith that printing in GNOME is not only can get better, but it's pretty clear how it's going to get better without too much effort. So, but we have, look, the good news here is, without wanting to be too down about the whole thing, if you write an application and you need to print some data to a printer and it's not too horribly complex, then it works. If you need to do really fiddly layout on the screen, it's a little bit icky, and like you want to use special fonts and this and the other thing, it's a bit fiddly. But everything's surmountable. The fact that Numeric and things like that can do printing, and Planner, the sort of project thing that's in GNOME, can do printing, is sort of a reasonably good advertisement that it works to a fairly large extent. Getting towards the end here, and my idea is when I finish this to do some demonstrations of just to show you a few things that I can't show very easily with slides. But here are some other sort of modules that maybe don't deserve all the slide on their own. But again, for the view from 5,000 feet, 500 feet, got higher there for a minute. Just to give you an idea of where to look for various things, VTE is a terminal widget. Back in GNOME 1, particularly, we used something called ZVT. In GNOME 2, what's his name? Who wrote this? I'm trying to think of the guy who wrote this. Forget it. Right. A guy from Red Hat who normally works on kernel stuff felt that it would be quite easy to write a terminal. And I guess when you work on kernel stuff, then writing a terminal widget is probably a bit easier. The whole idea, though, is it's a widget. It's not rather than write an entire terminal, he wrote a widget that would do everything a terminal would do so that other people can then use it in their applications, whether they're using it as a bonobo component or whether they're just directly importing it and using it, linking against libvte, and using it as a widget. So if you're writing any kind of IDE or something like that, VTE is something worth looking at. It behaves exactly like GNOME Terminal behaves, without the menu bar at the top and the window frame around it. It's fully accessible. It has all the GNOME accessibility support and stuff like that. It uses Pango to do the rendering so that our Arabic friends and our Indian friends can all use it and have their fonts displayed quite nicely. It is extremely cool, as I'll show you in a minute, to sort of display a file that has mixed Australian and, say, Chinese content and see all the Chinese characters popping up quite happily on the screen. That really blows away anyone who uses Windows, because they just don't seem to get that facility very often. It was actually written as a kind of experiment by this guy, because his logic, as he explains in the documentation, is, for those who understand sort of how terminals work on Unix and a bit of history, is there's the termcap file that basically, and terminfo, that basically explain here is how to implement certain features on this particular type of terminal. And it's a huge database of all these type of terminals, like VT100s, VT200s, all the way down the list, all these sort of weird terminals that you go, oh, I vaguely remember that machine back when I was in university. And it's sort of, here's the weird control characters we need to send to it, whatever, to make it draw inverse video, stuff like that. Well, the guy writing VTE said, well, let's reverse this. Let's use that as a description of what the terminal should do. And in a sense, he sort of turned it on its head and said, what I want to do is write something that works like a VT100, so, for example. And so he looks at, he says, okay, in termcap file describes how a VT100 should behave, what sequences it should accept to do reverse video and stuff. So I'll write something that operates like a VT100 like this. And it pretty much works. It was kind of a good idea, and it's very clean code. It's really beautifully written. Like, it's written by a guy who plays in the kernel most of the time, right? So he understands the value of maintainable code. GTK SourceView is kind of a cool module used in gedit to provide the source code coloring. And basically, if you have anything that you're writing that needs to do source, like computer language source code coloring, GTK SourceView is your friend here. It is something that hooks in quite nicely. It's a descendant of a text view widget and can provide coloring based on syntax files, so they're just XML files easy to edit. And it comes with any language under the sun, like C and Java and Python and Ruby and Perl and you name it, and it's already got the files with it. But every now and again, people come up with some sort of weird SQL dialect, or they're using R or something that we haven't written a syntax file for, and someone writes a new syntax file. So GTK source view is a nice file. And it comes with some examples as well. Libwank, or Libwank, or whatever, is another one of Havik Pennington's experiments. Too much free time at some point a couple of years ago. It basically, when he was writing Metacity, the GNOME window manager, he realized there's a whole bunch of functions that not only the window manager wants to know about, but many applications that work closely with the window manager will want to know about. And these are the things like, how do you get a list of all of the windows that the window manager knows about if you're writing a little application to show a window list? And how could you change the focus from one window to another? Or how can you minimize a window or maximize it? Things like that. So he pulled them all out into a separate library. So if you're writing any little tool like that that wants to play around with windows on that sort of level, this library is really your friend here, and you should use it, because it, particularly if you're trying to work in a sort of spec compliant way, because it's written by someone who has written a window manager that is used a lot, so he has some knowledge of the specification. And finally, just for people wanting to write GNOME panel applets inside GNOME panel, the maintainer has wrote a little library called libpanelapplet, I think it's still called that, that contains the sort of common functionality you want to be a panel applet. Panel applets are sort of special because they're not completely standalone applications, because the panel does a lot of the management for them, like the session management and stuff like that is done by the panel. The panel applets themselves get some of the clicks, and some of the clicks go through to the panel, stuff like that. So libpanelapplet provides a nice way, is worth looking at if you're writing a panel application. Just it provides initialization and functions like that that you might need to know. Yes? No. Notification area, which is the... wait, computer. I don't have one. How can I quickly make a notification applet? Yeah, Rhythmbox will do it. Oh. Sorry, I only installed the machine recently. Yeah, all right. Go away. Up here, this little set of notes that has appeared up here. This is the notification area, which is sort of like the system tray in Windows, and is in danger of being abused about as badly. We don't really have a clear cut policy in GNOME yet on when something should be using the notification area to display an icon, and when it should just be a normal sort of panel applet type of thing. But we've sort of got through, and this isn't for want of trying. Just every time we try, we come up with about 14 different opinions on what should be there. So the whole thing, including the little bar just above where my mouse is now, that little sort of ridge thing there, which is the side of the notification area, that is an applet of itself. And the icons that appear inside it, which are done by external applications wanting this, like Rhythmbox says, please put something inside there. And if I was playing a tune, that would be showing me the tune that's playing, and I can right-click on it, and you can see I can move to the next song and things like that. That is all supplied by a little separate piece of code called Egg Tray. There's a library in GNOME CVS called libegg, which amusingly someone asked recently what it stood for and got three answers within 2 days. But it's a combination of things from a few other GNOME libraries. Alternatively, it's the place where new GNOME applications hatch from. There's no end of puns, really, you can get from libegg. But basically, the whole idea is it's a library where people could develop new things, like the notification area applet, that had some kind of exit strategy. Their plan was eventually to move it into GNOME VFS or to move it into GTK or whatever. And at the moment, there's a little section in there called Egg Tray, which is responsible for putting little icons and managing them up in the notification area. And if you ever want to play around with this, the sort of thing to do is, for example, to look in Rhythmbox or to look in Game, things like this, and see how they use EggTray. And the whole idea with libegg, by the way, is the code from the libegg module. We never ever build libegg and install it. People should cut and paste the code. The theory being that stuff in libegg is not meant to be stable, could change at any point because it's under development, and when it's finished, it will be moved out of libegg into somewhere else. This may or may not be working. There's some things that have been in libegg for a very long time. They're fairly rotten eggs at the moment. And we keep sort of prompting people to do something with it. And it's not a forgotten thing. We just have to sort of, again, it's limited number of people doing large amounts of work, so we can't do everything at once. But it will happen. But yeah, certainly if you're using code from libegg, copy it into your particular source code and update it periodically. Like, look, for example, in Numeric, there's a whole bunch of shell scripts to import various code they grabbed from elsewhere that they update from time to time and then munch to their own satisfaction. Any other questions on these sort of random modules or other random modules I may have left out that someone's heard about and wondered about? Like, let's be fair here. I've probably covered about 15 to 20 modules today all up, and I've had slides on about a dozen of them, dozen and a half. And like I said, if you're going to build everything in GNOME, you're building 84 or 86 modules. If you're just building the libgnome platform release, you're building 53 modules or something like this. There's a lot of stuff in there, but you don't have to understand deeply every single module. Almost nobody does. What is sort of important is to know, if I'm trying to play around with user interface widgets, I need to look at GTK. Portability stuff, start looking at least at glib. My program management, maybe glib, look a bit in libgnome. File system stuff, look in GNOME VFS. Just trying to give you an idea of where to look. So far we've been reasonably language agnostic. I don't really care what your favorite programming language is. But in reality, you have to write your program in some kind of language. So there's a lot of GNOME code out there in C, but C is not everybody's favorite language for various reasons. So we've over time developed a very large number of language bindings to external popular languages. And these happen because someone interested in that language has come along and written the bindings and maintained them. But at the same time, down in GNOME C land, like, the C source code is written with language bindings in mind. So where functions in a library might normally take, for those who are familiar with C, they might take a var arg style of arguments, so an arbitrary number of parameters. We always provide a way to pack all of the parameters into an array and pass in the length of that array so that language bindings can call it. We don't have var arg style support. Things like that. And if anything like that's missing, someone will eventually point it out when it gets wrapped and it will be added. We're fairly friendly to language bindings by design. And so up there I've just listed a few of the ones that have very extensive language bindings, and I've no doubt forgotten some, which is why I put dot 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 at the bottom, just to pretend I've run out of room instead of forgetting them. Python, C++, C#, Java, Ruby, Perl, all of these have active developers, have active users. I'm reasonably involved in the Python ones in terms of sitting around on the mailing list making a lot of noise. I tend to use them a lot just for my own use and at work occasionally. They're fairly good. Again, a plug for another talk at this conference, 11 o'clock on Friday. James Henstridge will be talking about the GNOME Python bindings and how to do scripting with them and things like that. So if you're at all interested in that, go along and see them. There has recently been Murray Cummings, an active German member of the GNOME release team, has recently got organized a GNOME language bindings release, which is a bunch of languages who have all committed to a particular set of rules that, about API and ABI compatibility and how their packages are split up and things like that. And they're all being released on the same kind of schedule. This doesn't contain all of the language bindings in existence. At the moment, for example, the Python bindings aren't part of that release, but it contains a good number of them. And it's sort of kind of a good idea to have things on a similar release schedule like this, because at the moment there is a bit of disparity between what versions of GTK are supported by what versions of which language bindings and what their coverage is like. But most of those ones on that page have decent to reasonable language bindings, at least. Yes, sir? In what way? What do you mean? Pretty much, yes, they are independent in the sense that if GNOME Python was built on, say, an AIX box, and GNOME Python was built on a Linux box, and you wrote Python code that was portable between the two machines, and then you move the Python code over to the AIX box from the Linux box, it will run. Yeah, the interfaces to the libraries are not dependent on the platform in any way like that. There is a bit of a problem, by the way, for people who may occasionally have to delve into the underworld and work on Windows machines. GTK has been ported to Windows. Gconf runs on Win32-type platforms, libxml, all those. Of the things I've mentioned today, Bonobo is basically the one that hasn't been ported across for a number of reasons, which means that libgnome UI have not been ported across because of their Bonobo dependencies. This means things like, for example, Numeric, for a long time, which relies on libbonobo for menu merging, has not been able to be built on Win32. And Planner, which used to be called Mr. Project, which is a sort of Microsoft project-like product being built by a couple of crazy guys in Sweden, is not able to run on Win32, despite all the pleas on the mailing list, because it uses libgnome, which uses libbonobo. And basically, it needs the libbonobo stuff again. People are working on that. Numeric is just about to get to the point where it doesn't have a libbonobo dependency anymore. Jody Goldberg has re-implemented large portions of stuff that he needs there, and so Numeric may soon be able to build on Win32 fully. Planner is something long-term goal. We will get rid of the bonobo dependency there, and it will be able to build on Win32, but it has many more holes that need filling. Yes? This was sort of why I was saying Bonobo is both loved and despised by different people. Some people see it as a huge blocker on many, many forms of progress, and other people see it as quite useful for what it does. And if it can't be implemented on a particular platform, maybe that's a problem with the platform and things like that. Some applications are working, they don't fully need, for example, the component embedding. I'm not quite sure, for example, Numeric, I have to go and look at what Jody's done there. Because Numeric was using Bonobo components to do like the charting code and stuff like that once upon a time. It certainly was using the menu merging stuff. And it'll be interesting to see what he's done in terms of has the wheel been re-implemented there, or has he worked around it in other ways? I'm not really sure what the answer is to that type of stuff. But yeah, there is the risk that in working around these things, there's been certain amounts of square wheels reinvented. But it may just be people have thrown away the functionality they don't use and only re-implemented the bits they do use. Other questions? Yes? It's not a driving goal. It would sort of be something that would be nice to happen. But the sort of the real blocker is things like Bonobo and upwards, the Corba stuff, things like that. There's a large number, and there's probably any number of other problems too. I think at the moment, my personal opinion is we have enough things to work on without making that a... Yeah, yeah. And but it kind of seems strange to be building something to help wean people off Windows and then make it run on that box. So, I don't know. But anyway, look, there are language bindings out there in the tutorial notes. I'll put in links to all of their homepages, in case people are interested in going and following them up. Really, the thing to do is probably watch the language bindings releases as well, just to get a feeling for what's going on there. There are so really, no matter what language you write in, there's stuff around to use a lot of this stuff, particularly from the GTK level and up. You can even do sort of small amounts of GTK programming in Bash and things like that. So before I get on the demos, here's the first slide again. Hopefully we're a bit closer to actually fulfilling this goal, that people have an idea of the overview of what's going on. And I will fill in some of the blanks in the tutorial notes that they'll distribute on the conference CD so that people have these to go through. Okay, in the last few minutes, I'd like to show you a few things that can't be shown very easily on slides. By the way, if you're ever building an application and you get this sort of thing coming out, fix it. It's not called critical for no reason at all. Like someone's trying to do something with an empty pointer at that point. Okay, the first thing is, and let's pick a really stupid example. We have a nice about box. It has some small issues down the bottom. It has, oh yeah, it has in the background here, you can see it apparently also has some issues that we need to fix, but no one ever runs this from the command line, so very few people know that exists. I keep meaning to fix it. So okay, we have this nice about box that displays lots of English, which is all nice if you read English, but it's not so nice if you read some other language. Here's a nice example of Pango at work. Now, all right, Abel Chung, the guy who translates the, does the traditional Chinese translations, apparently hasn't got around to doing Gnome About just yet. But he's translated sort of portions of it. And the date down the bottom all works happily and stuff like this. And Pango is not really having much problem with this. Maybe the Japanese version is better because I think it's fully translated. Yeah, these are just sort of nice ones to use because it's clearly showing that we can do international rendering. It's not just that we can do translations. We can display this stuff as well without too much problem. There's a bit of flickering down the bottom with the date there. Yes? Anyone know the Arabic locale? Yeah, Hebrew, I think I've got problems with fonts. Oh no, I've got some fonts. Okay, so there we go. We do have certain amounts of right to left. We've got here a combination of right to left and left to right text going on, which works, which Pango is quite happily with. And even when you do editing, it's Pango actually understands the idea that if I've got left to right text and I'm hitting the right arrow button, when I hit the border, it remembers to split the cursor in GTK Text View, and then hitting the forward button starts moving right to left through the Hebrew and then back to right, left to right again. Yes? And there's clearly some other font problems going on here too. Look, okay, I don't use my laptop in Hebrew at all, so. And you can see also, by the way, free, no extra charge, it's put the button in the right position for that culture. Like you, people there are reading right to left, so we put the button in the last spot they're going to look. I mean, the final spot they're going to look, not the last spot they're going to look. We're not into hiding the button, right? This is the, as you naturally read it, you kind of want to end up on the button here. Yeah? It hits it. There's about five choices there, and it hits a different one every time. That was kind of a nice touch when these guys rewrote that. Yeah, I have no idea what the Arabic locale is. Apparently I have the Arabic fonts, right? So I'm dying to find that one out. But look, it just works. I feel certain, whoops. It almost worked. Came very close, but do have to put the country in as well. For anyone who reads German very well, this is probably just readable at this speed. For anyone who reads German at my speed, which is moderate to good but not brilliant, we're putting too much text in the paragraphs there. Your brain sort of falls over just before the last word as the next paragraph zooms up the page. But something that is very good about Gnome, if you're writing applications, even as a as a third party and you release it open source, we have an excellent translation team. Like 61 or 68 languages or something are at least more than trivially translated. We have certain regions of the world where there's no translation at all. It kind of sucks to live in Africa at the moment and use GNOME because we have almost no African languages, which is a bit sad. But yeah, the translation stuff is done excellently. And this is given that there's like, to do a reasonable translation of GNOME, like the desktop, the platform, evolution, numeric, you're translating of the order of 100,000 strings. And so a new team coming up, like recently within the last year, the Welsh team has sort of come in and done huge amounts of translation. That was about 8 people working really hard for about 8 months to get the platform and the developer libraries all translated. Because some of this is very non-rewarding for them. You translate the developer libraries, you're translating a bunch of menu items, right? It's really non-thrilling stuff. But then the file menu is used everywhere, so everyone gets saved translated for them correctly and stuff like that. Okay, so still some issues with the about box, like it does take 28 minutes to go through all of the names. Well, there are 340 something names, I've forgotten the exact count, in that box at the moment, which is about half of the people who possibly deserve to be there. And it takes a very long time to go through it, so we maybe should fix that. Yes? That was basically being done in raw code. It was using a canvas. So hold on, let's pop it up again. Basically, in the middle of the screen here, we have a canvas, and there's a text block being scrolled up it. And yes, there's a number of GNOME canvases actually. There's a library called libgnome canvas, that is sort of the if you like the officially blessed library, that is quite nice to use. And again, if you were just sitting out and wanting to use a canvas library in your application for whatever reason, I would say go use libgnome canvas. There's also another module called Foo Canvas, invented when names were clearly at a shortage. And it has some of the more specialized features of libgnome canvas removed for optimization features, but for optimization reasons. Like numeric uses Foo Canvas, for example, just because they want a very, very fast rendering library. Yes? Oh yeah, CEO, so you can see at the back there, it is using GNOME Canvas. Yeah, no, this one's just at some point around just before GNOME 2.4, the name of a parameter, the type of a parameter changed, and we're just not passing the right parameter at the moment. There's little things like that all the time when you run applications that it's not the end of the world, but we have to fix it. Someone else had their hand up? Yes? Oh gee. Yeah, okay. Lang is the sort of is the variable that your C library, like the glib C locale stuff, takes attention to. GDMLang, the problem is that you quite often want the language that GDM shows up in not to necessarily be the same language as you log in. For example, you imagine a bunch of terminals maybe at Hong Kong University, where they have a number of Chinese speakers and a number of English speakers. You don't necessarily want the GDM login screen to be in Chinese. That would make it very hard for me, for example. But a number of people want to log in Chinese. So I think GDMLang might be just a holdover from, it's a variable that got set at some point that sort of filtered down into your shell. I'm not 100% certain on that one, because what the exact variables that GDM sets and which ones GNOME pays attention to is something I haven't kept up on. But there are issues that you don't necessarily want the login language to be the same as the language you log, like the language GDM shows to be the same as the language you log in for. Yeah. Setting lang is what all these applications, like all the glib applications, pay attention to lang. you can even do set the sort of fallback languages, like say I want to use German, if you don't have that I'd like to use Japanese and so on. It doesn't completely work, but it works pretty much most of the time. There was another demo I was going to show too. Oh yeah, someone was asking me during the break. Think about keyboard shortcuts for a moment. Like, just to pick a random example here, Alt G will select the game menu, and if I hit Q, I'll get the quick menu, or over here in Help, if I hit A, I'll get the About menu, and C will get the Contents menu. That's all well and good, and everyone's quite happy and used to that. I didn't do it. Fellow t-shirt. hey, I've got a microphone back too. Computer display, maybe? And then we poke wildly at the buttons and all right, here we go. Woohoo, look at that. Okay, we're nearly there. So okay, here's the sort of what the normal screen looks like. Hey, it's getting brighter, isn't it? through the wonders of modern technology, we can be running many of these at the same time. Here's what the Chinese version looks like.
Chinese fonts show up there.
Oh, they look better there than do on my laptop. And you can see up here how they've solved the problem of keyboard shortcuts, just with the little letters after it. And similarly, Control-A and Control-Q haven't really changed much. It always looks good to read the about box for the sort of like the, one of these kind of languages. Translator. Japanese is much more interesting. They've got like a ton of them, and they've got their Japanese name and their Romanized name, and it's really quite handy. This is another thing that GNOME does fairly well, and if you are writing applications, it's worth looking at how other applications do the about box. It's like there's a fairly standard call to the about box, but it pops up a little translators tag in the when it's translated. Like, okay, the equivalent about menu for my English version has a written by blah blah blah, and that's it. Over here in the Chinese version, this second tag is actually the translators, and so the translators for whatever locale you're viewing it in pops up there, and there can be quite a number of translators in some applications. So that's sort of a way of giving them, because they do just as much work as the people who write the programs. Remember, these are the guys who are translating 100,000 strings for us, some of which are words like factory that they have no context around it, and they're trying to work out, what does it mean? How can that word possibly be used? We also have apparently gtally needs to be documented. I could think of a game quickly that was documented. I could think of an application that was documented. I mean, yeah, how hard can this be, right? But shut up. Yeah, I'm on the documentation team, right? You think I'd know this. But... Oh, yeah, that's right, because if Yelp needed documentation, we'd be in trouble. That was the logic. I remember that now. Oh, wait. Oh, hold on, this guy needs documented as well. Oh, this is embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah, Yelp would have a list, so that's a good thought. Yeah, let's look on games, because there is... Oh, look, Gnibbles. Okay, the problem here is that somebody just hasn't set up the documentation tag. They're not giving the documenters credit. Normally, there's meant to be a little documenters tag here as well that shows you who wrote the documentation. Because again, the documenters are not the guys who wrote the program. There's a GNOME documentation team that has a couple of coordinators at the moment. And there's a bunch of people there who don't program, who just use the applications. And for many people, it's a good introduction to GNOME or to anything, is to sit down and write documentation. And they write quite good documentation. We've put a lot of work in, and Sun have sort of contributed some of their editorial expertise, and we've created a good glossary list of words that you should use and words you shouldn't use, because we kind of like everyone to use the same words for the same concepts, just so that the documentation is consistent, and if the word is strange to you, you only have to learn it once, things like that. So yeah, the documenters there should get credit. Hopefully there's something that needs... Pardon? Yes. It's one of the games under the solitaire, isn't it? Oh, wrong button. Oh, but that just shows the whole thing's up. This is so sad. We'll spot the conference attendee who's listed in this list. Even kernel hackers, I mentioned Matthew Wilcox is speaking at this conference and normally spends his time doing kernel hacking for HP, but at one point he wanted to learn Scheme, so he wrote a bunch of card games for Isle Wight. I think Jonathan Blandford's right. The wife, Rosanna Yun, learned skiing for the same reason. She's addicted to solitaire card games. And Jonathan got sick of her bugging him to implement certain games and sort of taught her skiing so that she could enter the card games here. Yeah, and numeric does it, but it'll take ages to start up. All right, just trust me, there's meant to be a documentation tag. I think I have to send mail to a documentation list after this talk. Things we need to check before 2.6 comes out. Any sort of general questions? Because we're just about out of time here. So, yes? No, that was something that was in GTK. Yeah, but, okay, GIMP has certain user interface requirements that are based on working the way a tool like that might work. Like, yeah, GIMP sort of has certain special requirements, so let's leave that aside for a minute. LibGNOME UI in GNOME 1.x, 1.4, 1.2, did have an MDI interface. We kind of threw it away because the logic was that it's probably better in the X Unix environment to have multiple windows rather than be having MDI. We still have notebook-style tabbed things, but the having one containing window that contains many other... MDI, for those who don't know, is multiple document interface. It's sort of a thing that's fairly popular, I'm not sure if it is now, but was in the past, on Microsoft Windows-style systems of having one big window for your application, which contained many other little small windows that were constrained within the big window. Similar to, like, the sort of initial driving logic was word processors having multiple documents open in essentially independent-looking windows. For a Unix-style environment running X, that's not really the type of idiom that we're used to, and people feel more comfortable just being able to have multiple windows that they can move around quite happily. So if you open up multiple things in Numeric or in Abbey Word or anything like that, you get multiple windows opening up that you can then move around. So unfortunately, no, there's not, and it's kind of by design. Right, okay. They saw what we were doing and have clearly followed. Yes? Yeah, there are a number of people who are actively working on it. Whether they're making any impression at all on the maintainers is an entirely different question. Basically, the problem is, if you look back on the GIMP developer mailings particularly, which is where this topic flares up every few months, the problem is you get people who say, oh, we should do it this way, it should be done like this, it's clear it's got to be done like this. You get a whole bunch of people who use the GIMP essentially professionally who point out that if it was done like this, there'd be no end of problems for people using it that way. And the problem is, with something like the GIMP, it's very hard to come up with a user interface that suits everyone. There's no sort of obvious right answer for everyone. The decision has sort of been made, and I'm not speaking for the GIMP developers here, but I hang out on the mailing list, so I think I'm sort of correct in saying the decision has kind of been made that there may be a little bit of a learning curve upon entering the GIMP the first few times to learn how to use it, with the payoff that once you get familiar with it, it remains productive. Some of the problems with making user interfaces that are very easy to use initially is you rapidly hit the wall of it stops being productive after a while. But yeah, look, there's been some tweaks in GIMP 2.0 is now in pre-release. Between GIMP 1.2 and GIMP 2.0, if you haven't seen the latest pre-releases, it might be worth downloading and having a look at it. There's been quite a number of changes in the way the toolbox is laid out, and you don't tend to have the 3,000 tool windows because they can now all be docked onto the main toolbar. I don't have it on this box, unfortunately, I can't show you. But the logic being that instead of having the layers palette and the tool properties palette and the color selector all being separate, they can all be dragged onto the one toolbar. So you've essentially got one toolbar floating around the screen plus your image windows. And yeah, there's sort of, it flares up periodically, and a lot of it's repetitive arguments, and so you can search GIMP developer list and find out why it's not like. The developers are certainly open to change, but it's got to be changed that also passes the artists who use the program a lot. Other questions? Yes? There's There's been quite a bit of actual work done on YELP in the last, like in the 2.5 development series, for example. All of the YELP is the GNOME help viewer, essentially. The thing when you click help, it starts up this thing called YELP, which is how help is pronounced in Swedish. Apparently, these Swedish guys have some sense of humor. Not much, but some. It reads in the DocBook XML and it runs it through, it used to run it through normal Ultra style sheets for converting this into HTML, and that would display it in an HTML viewer. In recent times, Sean McCants, who's the guy now maintaining YELP, has gone through and pretty much written his own set of style sheets to parse the XML. It is much faster, like a couple of orders of magnitude faster. So, and there are now a couple of presentation problems he's getting out, but yeah, basically YELP, as it will be in GNOME 2.6, will look the same as in GNOME 2.4, but it will run a lot faster. It has a few other little things tweaked as well. It's had a lot of work done on it in the last 4 or 5 months. It's one of the big improving sections of GNOME in the next release, actually. Yeah, things like that, and inconsistent output and tidying up bits of it and things like that. There's also some work going on the covers about how we read the documentation in and stuff like that. So basically YELP suffered a bit from, it was kind of 85% done and the maintainer had too many things on his plate, and now we've got a really key maintainer who's quite good at programming and quite good at design. So stuff's going on. Other questions? Yes. Oh yeah, showing a terminal showing different languages. Yeah, all right, let me find an example. Well, all right. Here we have, this is one of the XML files that is actually used by Bonobo component, by libbonobo, to start up a server. In this case, starting up, you can essentially embed the help viewer as a Bonobo component. And so beyond saying, okay, my IID is, lost my mouse here, is GNOME YELP Factory, and I implement this very exciting thing called Generic Factory. But people have translated the name of this. Like, this is the sort of exciting work the translation team occasionally have to do. I have no end of respect for these guys because they really have to translate some fairly mundane stuff. But everyone's translated the word YELP Factory. And so you can see here we've got, this is Amharic, Arabic, Farsi down here. All these fonts that I didn't used to have, that's really cool. Japanese. It's kind of up to the teams whether they try and make some kind of idiomatic translation of words like YELP, or whether they leave it as YELP and translate the other bits, or whether they do a phonetic translation. But you can see here we've got, we're starting to get into Cyrillic languages, Serbian, Russian. The boxes mean I have no font for Tamil in this case. Wouldn't believe the languages I can't use on my computer. Yeah, and I seem to have Hindi font problems as well, but that's because of the lack of a widely available good Hindi font. Like, even, that's one of the problems the GNOME India guys are having, that they just don't have the good fonts for a lot of the things they're representing. And piecing together bits and pieces from freely available fonts to make things, to make something that works, like taking bits from here that they need and bits from here, and the problem there is that nothing quite matches. It's all a bit up and down. I thought I had a Greek font, but we didn't seem to be seeing any Greek letters here. But okay, that sort of gives you an idea that GNOME Terminal has no problems at all displaying languages on the screen that go right to left, left to right, changing back and forth within a line without any problems. That kind of stuff is pretty cool, actually. I do some work with a client in Hong Kong, and so we occasionally have to read data that contains Chinese characters and English characters, and actually being able to see the changed characters, even though I can't read them, there's people in my office who can, but I can also match it up and go, yes, that character's the same as that character, and stuff like that. It means you can read all your Korean spam, too. It's really cool like that. Yeah. Okay, any more questions? All right. Before you go, please either fill out the manual speaker form saying, yes, inviting back next year, all expenses paid, or go to the online, you can do it online if you would like. If you fill out the form here, there's a box over on the registration deck to put it in. Oh, and there's also apparently one by the back door. Thank you.